Inch by inch, row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground.
Hello, and welcome to the Garden Goddess Show on WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin. I'm Donna Smith, and I'm happy to be talking gardening with you for the next half hour. On today's show, I'm going to introduce you to Andre Paquette, owner of Firefly Farm and Mercantile in Cashton, Wisconsin. It's that time of year for putting out your veggie starts or going to the greenhouses to buy your plants to get the garden planted. Andre's going to share his tips for a successful vegetable garden. We'll also cover some garden tools today, and I'll let you know about a couple of gardening books worth checking out. Let's get started with a couple of questions from the garden cart. You can email your garden questions to gardening@wdrt.org, and I will try to answer them on a future show. Catherine asked if she should repot an alocasia and sent me a picture. These go by the common name elephant ears. Alocasia will begin growing in the spring, so this is the best time to repot them, Catherine. Repotting will encourage new growth. They like to be a bit root-bound, but not so much that it stunts their growth. Pick a pot that's about 1 to 2 inches larger than the one it's currently in, which is a good rule of thumb when repotting most any houseplants. Water the plant well a day or so before repotting. When you remove it from the pot, be sure to check the root ball for any signs of rot and trim away damaged sections of the roots. Use a well-draining potting mix and water once it's in the new pot. Avoid fertilizing that newly repotted plant for about 2 to 3 months while it adjusts to its new environment. I picked up some new lavender plants to add to my garden this spring. Afterwards, I came across an article about fertilizing the lavender from a website called thegardenbeds.com. Fertilizing at the proper time can really help to improve the amount and quality of the blooms on your plant. If you fertilize with a high nitrogen fertilizer, you're going to stimulate more foliage growth and won't get the best floral display. Here's a few easy tips for fertilizing your lavender. These can also apply to most perennials in your garden as well. Fertilize once in early spring instead of a fall or winter feeding. Use a low nitrogen balanced fertilizer, one with nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Water deeply when the soil is dry, and be sure your lavender is in full sun. And prune out the dead in the spring as needed. I've talked to a number of people that some of their plants like lavender, some roses, sage, and other herbs that normally come back every year died completely back to the ground this winter. I experienced this as well. So you'll want to prune out the dead now if you're seeing new growth coming from the base of the plant. If you aren't seeing anything by now, then you'll need to replace them. When I worked at an arboretum, we used June 1st as our absolute last day for leaving something that looked dead. So pick a date that works for you around this time of year, like Memorial Day. I was also asked a question about broccoli and why the plant was not producing the broccoli florets. Instead, it was just producing a lot of green leaves. Well, vegetables tend to be heavy feeders, meaning they need fertilizer more often than, say, perennials like the lavender I spoke of earlier. Most vegetables require a low nitrogen balanced fertilizer. Tiffany from Deep Rooted Organics in Westby recommends the Sustain brand natural organic flower and vegetable plant food. It's a granular 4-6-4 organic fertilizer, perfect for edible plants. The numbers 4-6-4 are the amounts of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium in that bag of fertilizer. It's a slow release, so they'll feed throughout the season. The lower nitrogen is formulated to provide the plants with the essential nutrients that it needs without too much nitrogen to overwhelm them. These fertilizers contain a rich supply of phosphorus and potassium, which are the key for strong root development, flowers, and fruits rather than excessive leafy growth. The flowers and ultimately the fruit is what we want in a vegetable garden to get those yummy peppers, tomatoes, and the broccoli. It's time for our patio talk today with my guest, Andre Paquette, owner of Firefly Farm and Mercantile in Cashton, Wisconsin, with his wife, Bonnie. Welcome, Andre.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
Good.
Glad you're here. So tell me, to start off, how long have you been a gardener, Andre?
Oh, well, that's going to age me. Really, probably 8 or 9. Got the hands dirty, and then just jumped right into gardening into my teenage years. So it's been kind of a long journey for me. So I really enjoyed it.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And during your time gardening, have you seen the winter kill that we've seen on a lot of plants this season?
Oh, sure. Winter kill is nothing abnormal, although when it hurts or hits you, you kind of feel like it's personal.
Right.
You know, I get calls every now and again, oh, this didn't make it or this happened. And I say, you know what? You're not alone. This winter was harsh. It was dry going into fall, into the winter. You had no snowpack. And then we had a few nights of some polar temperatures, you know, plunge down. So, like, my lavender was looking great until second week of January. And after second week of January, my lavender said, oh, man, this is not where I want to be right now.
Right.
And I looked and I said, well, you know, I'm not gonna protect 4 or 5 plants next to the road.
Right.
So I just replace them if I want or put something else there.
Yeah, it gives you a good opportunity to change up some things in the garden.
It does. And what affects things most are maybe some of those plants that are on the margins. Maybe you didn't mulch your rows this year, and you probably should have. You know, just because it says zone 4 hardy, there's usually some other things you can do to kind of help that. Thornless blackberries. We love thornless blackberries, but in our valley of zone 4, we didn't have them all make it through this year. You know, most made it through, but a few decided, hey, we're done for the year. We're not coming back just because we don't mulch those either in our orchard. They just are part of it. Maybe you have some fancy nativars. Those are cultivated or very selected native selections. Really popular is some of the black-eyed Susans, some of the echinacea, you know, that might be orange or green or the purple twist or what have you. Those may not come back.
Right.
Just because they're just not quite as hardy as their native counterparts. So, you know, just take stock that winter kill happens. And if it's never happened to you up until this winter, then you have, like, won the garden lottery for all those years. But it's going to happen again, and there's steps that you can do. You know, you can mulch, you can water well, maybe a new perennial bed. You know, these things do make a big difference.
Yeah, and especially, like, evergreens and things like that, if you're planting those in the fall, they can take a big hit, too. And so watering, you know, can be really important up until the ground starts to freeze.
Yep, watering helps.
Definitely. When we talked prior to the show, you mentioned that you have some great tips also for vegetable gardeners to help them grow better plants and get a bigger harvest from their garden. Can you share a few of those tips with us this morning?
Sure. I'll say the first tip is time, and that's planting at the right time. We had great warm weather. And I know there's a lot of people who planted peppers and tomatoes last week or a couple weeks ago. And they're, you know, with this weather, this cool weather that came in for a week, it may set those tomatoes and peppers back a little bit. So if you haven't planted yet, it's okay. Or if you feel like you're late, you're not late. We plant tomatoes and peppers all the way through second, third, fourth week of June. We get them in there. We partially do this. You know, when you plant 500-600 peppers and tomatoes every year, you sort of learn that you can't really plant them all at one time. But also, like May 31st last year, we had a frost.
Yeah.
It wiped out 200 peppers that we were sort of staging. There really wasn't a sign for frost. It just kind of happened. The wind shifted in the middle of the night, and we ended up with 30 degrees in our valley May 31st.
Yeah.
So these things do happen, and I'd say time is your number one friend. Second thing is, compost. We religiously top dress all of our beds every single year. So for vegetables, they are feeders. You have heavy feeders like cabbage, These are things that require constant inputs of some sort. So obviously cover crops, you can till those back in, but really a nice layer of compost every year makes a big difference. Tomatoes, we always get the questions, or people are bringing in like examples of their fruit or pictures of their blossoms. And I talk about blossom rot quite a bit with folks and how to prevent it. And just a little extra calcium in your garden makes a world of a difference. If you want to go organic and get like a calcium additive from the feed store, from the garden center, you can. Or, you know, some of my tomatoes just like Tums. We'll break off half a Tum, put in the bottom of every tomato plant. Sometimes with dahlias, we'll do the similar thing, and we even put alfalfa pellets in.
Oh, really?
And alfalfa pellets give you kind of a quick boost of nitrogen.
Okay.
Sometimes. So some of these things you can just add as you go. Now, does broccoli need that? No, broccoli is not going to really need that extra help the same way. So, but those are some of the things that we do. And then I'll say one of the biggest issues is, don't be afraid to cover your vegetables that don't need to be pollinated. So cabbages, broccolis, your brassicas, your lettuces, your kales. You know, either you plant them out maybe kind of big, or you have some seeds out there going. There's moss, there's critters. Everything wants to eat those luscious greens or get into your cabbage.
So is that where you see those row covers over things?
Yep. You just put some mesh right over it. We have it on giant rolls we cut for people. But it really does make a big, big difference. If it doesn't have to be pollinated and you start to see the moths and the butterflies fly around, it's okay to cover them up.
Okay. So. That's a good tip. Yeah, because I've seen those before and always wondered what was the timing on that. You know, when would you put them on? When would you take them off? And is there a life cycle for those moss where then that gives you that opportunity to remove those covers?
There's really no reason to. Your moss are all summer long.
Yeah.
So you're going to get certain critters and pets, and they're going to come out. The only sad part is sometimes if you have a predatory pest, it can't quite get in. Maybe an aphid got in there or something along those lines. But for us, the cabbage moth is our number one.
Right.
And they tend to love the brassicas. So we just simply will cover them up. And if I don't cover them up, sometimes I lose them, especially if I don't have a lot of companion plants, some herbals, you know, companions or the marigolds, and some of the classics to kind of help deter them or camouflage those brassicas.
Are there other plants that benefit from having companion plants planted near them?
Oh, yeah. And you're going to have two types of listeners. You're going to have the listeners that that are science-based, that really believe that companion planting is very limited and very small and scoped. And then you have others that are just, they want those garden folklore of, I'm going to put this with that just because grandma did. And that's okay. And both are not wrong. There's really, in the companion plant world, it really goes back to how you define the benefits of companion planting.
Okay.
So for example, in the world of companion plantings, I personally believe, and this is my definition, I plant a group of plants together where at least one benefits. And that's it. That's as simple as it gets. So for example, maybe it's just something from the classic French marigold, and not every marigold is exudes this. We've sort of bred it out as things look beautiful and we want certain traits. You breed the effectiveness of sometimes their insect prevention, or you know how they help camouflage things out there or repel insects. But you know, marigolds are pretty strong. Herbs are always wonderful. Nasturtiums, I cannot say enough about nasturtiums. Just really a lot of fun. You know, so there's things that you can do to really tuck these guys in. What they're doing is they're repelling through their scent, but maybe like sulfur cosmos, those are the cosmos that are orange and yellow and kind of vibrant colors. They attract a lot of ladybugs. And those ladybugs are great in the garden. So sometimes it's just a matter of planting even your beneficial pollinator plants, whether it's the borage that attracts the bumblebees, or you just want some open-faced zinnias or dahlias, because you just want to get the pollinators, you know, happy in there. And that makes a big, big difference too.
Right. Yeah, because attracting those pollinators, that's going to, you know, potentially boost your production of fruits and vegetables from those vegetable plants.
Yep, absolutely. I'd say the other part of companion gardening is it doesn't even have to be chemical. It can be physical. So for example, lettuce is a really hard crop in the summertime, in the heat of the summer. It's a quick crop, but it grows successfully. Everyone can grow lettuce successfully. You just have to maybe shade it a little bit. So a tomato plant or a cucumber or beans up the vine, you know, they cast shade, and they cast afternoon shade. And so from a physical perspective, you can look for companion plants to where they can shade something else out for you.
Okay, that's great. I was also thinking about kind of breaking up the monoculture of a vegetable garden somewhat by adding some of those other plants in so that, you know, if something starts wiping out a group of pepper plants or tomato plants, if you have some in another area, you have some barriers in between of those plants, that could be beneficial also.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion on that in the permaculture world, like a permaculture orchard, for example, where you every tree, every third tree is different, or every other tree is different all the way down. It follows a pattern of some sort. To make it easy on the gardener or the orchardist. But in the gardening world, it's nice to break things up. But herbs really do make a big difference in kind of preventing, helping some of your vegetables survive.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we're starting to run out of time, so we're going to need to wrap up this morning. I'm so thankful for you to drop in and so that we could have this discussion, and we're going to definitely have you back again to talk about permaculture a little bit more. And when I stopped at out at the farm last week and I saw the vast number of seed packets that you have in your store, we didn't even have time to talk about all of those seed packets. But if you are in the market for some garden seeds, visit Andre and Bonnie out at Firefly Farm and Mercantile and check out their seed packets. How long would you say people have to still put in some seeds in their garden?
It doesn't end. If you're alive and breathing, you can put seeds in. You just do it differently.
Yeah.
So we seed constantly all season long throughout the seasons. And, you know, by the time January's in the winter, there's things to seed, like your onions and your leeks and maybe some of your really slow-growing herbs. So there's always something you can do.
Okay. Well, Andre has a selection. He starts out the season with about 1,800 different varieties of seed packages out there at the farm, and there's still plenty on the walls, I can tell you, because I saw them last week. So
if we ever run out of seed, there is something wrong, and, you know, just grab your family and get to a safe place, because we have seeds, and many of our suppliers and our own, we do seeds year-round. Now, you may not get that exact variety you're looking for in the middle of August. You may have to wait till October, November, but if you're not picky, we'll have a category for you at least.
So. Okay, great. Well, we'll revisit that topic again on a future show, because I'd like to hear more about the various varieties and how people make decisions about what to plant with those seeds. So thank you very much, Andre. I'm sure that you've already given our listeners some great tips for their garden this summer, and we'll have another conversation in the future.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming today. Bye-bye. Now on to the bookshelf selection for this month. When I stopped in at his store, I asked Andre about a favorite book. As any gardener might say, there are a lot of great books out there. One of his favorites is Four Season Harvest, Organic Vegetables from Your Garden All Year Long by author Elliot Coleman. In this book, you'll learn some season-extending techniques to be able to eat garden-fresh food all year long. You don't have to stop harvesting vegetables at the end of the summer. Instead, you'll learn techniques to successfully raise a variety of winter vegetables. Coleman includes a wide range of tips, including composting techniques, site prep and building a cold frame, simple mineral soil amendments, types of seeds for four seasons, dealing with snow, and storage techniques for the veggies you grow. Andre's advice, if you're a beginner or a seasoned gardener, this is a book filled with lots of useful gardening tips for everyone. Another book that you may find helpful is Rodale's Garden Insect Disease and Weed Identification Guide by Miranda Smith and Anna Carr. It's like a field guide to everything that may go wrong in your garden. And we'll start seeing those things popping up anytime now in our yards. This book will help you identify major insects, diseases, and weeds right in your garden. It's a good reference on the life cycles of these insects, diseases, and weeds. Information includes the range in which each species is typically found, a general description, host plants that you'll find them on, their feeding habits, and organic control methods. One of the things I really like is the section on weeds, where they illustrate the seedling stage of the plants as well as the mature flowering plant. So many seedlings seem to look a lot alike, so having these to use for identification is a great help. The book also has a section in the back with actual photographs of most of the pests included in the book. It's an older book, but you can still find it online and in used bookstores. In the tool shed, we're looking at edging tools this month. I'm always on the lookout for ways to simplify my garden maintenance. Even though it's an extra step in the spring, I have found that edging the beds can really be helpful to keep the grass and the creeping Charlie from totally invading the bed. I was visiting a friend recently, and her newly edged beds with some fresh mulch made her plants really pop, and the front garden really looked nice. So my tool of choice for edging is a half moon edger. This tool is on a long handle, and the blade is D-shaped, like a half moon. It also has a kick plate on top, like your shovel and spade has. And this allows you to step on it to get into the ground. Then you pull back on the long handle and lift the clod of soil out of the ground. You can just compost those soil clumps or shake off the dirt into your garden bed and then compost the clumps of grass that are left. With a good trench along the front of the bed, the grass is less likely to creep in. Edging your beds early gives you a nice line in which to mulch your beds, and then everything looks fresh and neat for the beginning of the season. One trick for edging your beds, too, to make a nice line so it's easy to mow, is to lay out your garden hose and then just push your lawnmower along that to make sure that you can get around those curves on the bed. And it's nice to get edging out of the way before there's a lot of weeding to do. And we all know that will happen at some point. The Garden Journal this month has a few tasks for you to keep in mind in the days ahead. If you haven't done so already, you can put out flowering annuals to brighten up your landscape. Houseplants that you may want to take outside can be put out in the days ahead as well. If you need to get them to acclimate to the environment, changes from those environmental changes from indoors to outside, put them out during the day and then bring them in at night for a few days so they can get used to being outside. As I said, weeding time is coming. The weeds are already starting to pop up, so you might need to get outside and do a little weeding. Mulching your flower beds can help to reduce the number of weeds and improve the soil quality, making those weeds much easier to pull out. You still have time to get in your summer bulbs now through about mid-June. And it's been pretty dry recently. And when we finally got some rain the other day, I realized I hadn't put out my rain gauge yet. If you don't have a rain gauge to be monitoring how much rain we're getting, you may want to get one so you know when your garden may need supplemental watering. If you don't want to get a fancy rain gauge, a couple of cat food cans or tuna cans will, when they're full, that's about an inch of water. Most plants in the garden need around an inch to an inch and a half of water a week. Newly planted plants will need more water for a while until they get better established. Wisconsin horticulturist Melinda Myers recently reminded gardeners on her Instagram page that I saw that blossoms on your spring flowering shrubs are starting to fade soon. Now's the time to prune those plants. You don't need to prune every branch on every plant, just those that need a little tidying up. You might pick and choose the plants that need the most attention in any given year to cut down on the amount of maintenance that you're doing. You'll have till about mid-July to do that pruning before the plants set their buds for next spring. Those shrubs would be things like lilacs, viburnums, forsythia. If you wait to prune the spring flowering plants during the dormant season, you remove the flower buds and won't have as many blooms next spring. Rule of thumb, prune spring flowering shrubs right after they flower. You might have heard the term used to describe this as plants that flower on old wood. Those plants that bloom later in the summer are flowering on new wood, which means they put on new growth in the spring and then flower on that new growth. These are the plants that you would typically prune during the dormant season. Pruning properly helps to stimulate new growth and keeps your plants vigorous and healthy. Well, it's time to wrap up today's show. We'll end with a quote from Hugh Johnson. No two gardens are the same. No two days are the same in one garden. Thanks so much for joining me today. I've enjoyed spending this time with you and with my guest, Andre Paquette from Firefly Farm and Mercantile. Please join me again on the fourth Monday of next month for another look into the garden. Have a wonderful day. Let's go out and make our world a little more beautiful, one plant at a time.